Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast. Each week, our host David Hunt speaks to a leading startup CEO, executive, or thought leader in the clean tech sector. Focused on the clean energy and clean mobility transitions, each guest shares the highs and lows of their clean tech journey, their industry insights, and their vision and hopes for the future.
Hello, I'm David Hunt, and thank you for joining me again on the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast. Hope you're all keeping safe and well. This week, we're talking fuel cells, as I speak to Ceres Power CEO Phil Caldwell. Phil has worked in the fuel cell industry for 17 years, starting his career at ICI as a chemical engineer. Phil made his transition to from the chemical industry to clean tech, becoming commercial director at Intelligent Energy, a UK developer of PEM fuel cells, mainly for automotive applications. Phil became CEO of Ceres in 2013 as part of a major turnaround. And under his leadership, Ceres has grown into a world-class clean energy technology business, growing from 50 million to more than 1 billion market cap and creating over 300 engineering and technology jobs in the process. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast, Phil. Thanks very much for joining me in what's clearly been a very, very busy week, given the deal that Ceres announced this week, and obviously looking forward to much more of that, or talking much more about that later on. Most of my guests are founder CEOs. In fact, I think you're the first CEO of a listed company we've had on the show, which of course has many of its own unique challenges, which would be great to talk through some of those. But in the first instance, can you share a little bit of your journey from graduating as a chemical engineer to ending up as the CEO of Ceres?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, David. And thanks for having me on. So I grew up originally in Liverpool, and I basically did engineering, chemical engineering, because I wanted to know that I could get a job afterwards. So I became a chemical engineer because I think I figured out it was the highest paid of the engineering disciplines at the time. And I was lucky enough at 18 to actually get a scholarship from ICI in Runcorn. So at 18, I spent a year on site on the banks of the Mersey, and they paid for me to go to university, which is almost unheard of now. I can't believe it. But I went to Imperial College in London and did chem eng. And after graduation, I rejoined ICI, and I was on the traditional engineering path, and I became a chartered engineer doing design and commissioning and those kind of things. But I suppose I always wanted to, I was always more intrigued by the business side of things. And I was working on the main big chemical plants in ICI, and I desperately wanted to get a job in commercial. I remember going and talking to the head of engineering at that time, and he said to me, "Look, Phil, if you go commercial, you know, you can't come back. We hire chemical engineers out of Imperial and Cambridge, and we hire humanities graduates to do our commercial stuff, and never the twain shall meet." And it never quite, it was kind of weird for me. So I sought out what was quite an unusual business at the time, which was the electrochemical technology business at ICI. And what they did is they actually took ICI technology and they licensed it and sold it to plants around the world to put in electrolyzers that made chlorine and caustic soda out of salt. You know, Cheshire was built on salt plains. So I had this fantastic job in my mid-20s of going around the world supporting plants in, and I had customers in China, in Indonesia, in India, in Colombia, all kinds of different places. And I would literally go as a one-man band, and I was technical service, so I'd go and check everything out and work with the plant manager, and then I would make sure everything was running properly, and then I would sell them, if you like, the upgrades, the refurbishments, the overhauls. And then I moved into business development. And at that time, ICI had changed quite dramatically from a top of the FTSE to being taken over by INEOS, and I kind of felt that was the time to make a move. And I was lucky enough to go to business school. I got another scholarship. I've been very fortunate with that, by Sainsbury's Management Fellows backed by the Royal Academy of Engineering, who wanted more engineers in business. And they paid for me to go to business school for 2 years in Barcelona, which was like a dream come true. And while I was there, they were big on entrepreneurship. So they were all about how do you finance startups and venture capital and all of those good things. And while I was there, one of my professors mentioned this weird and wonderful startup company out of Loughborough, which was a fuel cell company. And having come from electrochemical technology, it's the same family. I realized that I obviously knew quite a lot about this technology. So I went and spoke to this company, which was a spin out of Loughborough. And I that's when I joined them, because they were very interested in my Asian business development experience and the fact that I was, you know, I had relevant technology experience. And that's how I got into the clean tech side. So the company was Intelligent Energy, and they were a spin out of Loughborough University, and they were private. So I've lived in that private clean tech kind of company for 10 years. And I kind of, you know, graduated through the ranks and became the commercial director there, and set up joint venture with Suzuki in Yokohama to do fuel cell motorcycles, and worked on BMW programs for automotive, etc. So I had a, you know, really good experience at Intelligent Energy. And then I was approached in 2013 to take on the chief executive's role at Ceres. And Ceres was a spin out of Imperial with a very different type of technology than Intelligent Energy, but I'd never really had any dealings with it. But again, they were interested in my experience of partnering and being able to do business with big corporates. So I came in as the chief executive in 2013, and that was a very different experience. First, leadership position of that kind of organization, and also being a public, you know, the difference between being private and being public is quite significant as well. And also coming in at a time of a turnaround where, like many, you know, clean tech startups, you have these ups and downs. And, you know, I've lived through a couple myself, and then how you actually grow a company from that position. So that's kind of how I ended up where I am today, through that path of engineering to commercial to business, really.
It's quite a journey in obviously, A, your career and those interesting steps, but also interesting to see how energy broadly and the industry has changed significantly over that period of time. I think I actually went to the ICI Runcorn site, must be about 10 years or so ago, maybe slightly less, to do some work with ACAL Fuel Cells, who were on the old ICI site, which was interesting just to see this sort of massive campus that clearly has, you know, as you say, one time was a FTSE leading business, and how, you know, that world is entirely changed. But very good learning, I'm sure, and actually sort of that element of traveling and having both that technical and commercial experience clearly really paying its dividends now for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ICI Foundation was a fantastic learning experience, and, you know, the path they gave to getting charter, etc., was really good, but quite unusual now. I think, you know, it used to be you join a company like ICI and you would be there for life, and the guys that I was with all talked about their pensions, which was the main driver for why they, you know, were set up for life. I remember when I got the job at ICI, my dad came in and said, "You'll never need to worry about where you work ever again," kind of thing. And that didn't really appeal to me. I always wanted to do something more exciting, really. But I think that world's changed, and people should expect to have, you know, two or three careers in their lifetime, kind of, you know, and that's where I am today.
I think what's really interesting, again, around entrepreneurship, most of, as we said, the guests I have are founders, CEOs of organizations, but it's really fascinating to see that entrepreneurial mindset having come from so many different places, some purely from commercial, some clearly from, you know, PhDs or sort of very technical areas, and some people leap straight into startups, and some come through large corporations like yourself. But it's that mindset that's really hard to describe. But I would say these days, without that, it's really challenging, I think, to build a career in many instances. You know, there certainly aren't too many places where there's that sort of career for life mentality or ability these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what I encourage, you know, people working with me to experience as much as possible, even if you're in a technology or engineering kind of role, is that customer exposure. Because getting out, what was quite formative for me was going to China as a young engineer and doing business there and understanding the culture and understanding how business gets done really drives a certain mentality back into how you approach the engineering and technology side as well. And I think exposing people to that from an early stage is really helpful, because it gives you context of what you need to deliver to be successful. So that's you know, definitely been my mindset the whole of my career is have that commercial approach to how we build these businesses.
Yeah. No, I'd like to return to that. But one thing I was keen to explore with you, Phil, your thoughts on hydrogen in the broader energy transition. But before we sort of take that helicopter view, perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about your fuel cell technology. Because, again, we have had a number of guests from the fuel cell side of things. But most people know about batteries and lithium ion. But fuel cells tend to get lumped into the strange thing that nobody really understands much about. So perhaps you could tell us a little about your specific technology, why it's different, and some of its key applications and markets. And, of course, then let's move on to the big news from this week. But if we can start with the technology particularly.
Yeah, so let me start with an overview of fuel cells. So fuel cells aren't new. You know, they were invented by a Welshman, William Grove, about 40 years before the internal combustion engine. And then they were picked up really by NASA in the 60s as part of the space missions with an earlier stage of alkali fuel cells. And then coming along later, I think out of Los Alamos Labs in the US, you had PEM technology. And that's the technology I worked on for 10 years on the automotive side. When I was in intelligent energy, and all these technologies have strengths and weaknesses, but that's probably the fuel cells that most people are familiar with, because they're the type of fuel cells that run on pure hydrogen, and they're the kind of things that you see on a Toyota Mirai or on buses if you see them running in different cities now. So they're the kind of what I would call pure play hydrogen fuel cells. And for me, part of my frustration was that technology is pretty mature. And the thing that's always held it back was this whole chicken and the egg about when do we have hydrogen infrastructure and how do we grow that business from, you know, which comes first, the demand for the fuel cells or the refueling infrastructure. And then when I was approached about the Ceres position and the Ceres technology, it appealed to me, because what we have at Ceres is a different type of fuel cell. It's a solid oxide fuel cell. And the big plus point for me is it's fuel flexible. And what I mean by that is it can run on conventional fuels today, like natural gas, and it can run on hydrogen, and it can run on blends of natural gas in hydrogen, and it can run on biofuels. So it's using different fuels, if you like, as the hydrogen carrier. And that for me took away a whole, a barrier, if you like, to commercialization, because suddenly the infrastructure side wasn't the issue. And then you could get on and focus with it. And where solid oxide fuel cells play particularly well is in stationary power applications, because it's high efficiency. So the fuel cells that we've developed at Ceres are now more efficient than a centralized megawatt scale combined cycle gas turbine, but something that is deployable and could be put in your house or in your home or in a data center, etc. And that's really powerful when you think about the energy transition, because you know, we've always been trying to balance big centralized infrastructure projects and assets versus more and more intermittent renewable energy. And if you think about being able to now have something that's more efficient than centralized power plants, but can be distributed, you have a much more flexible energy system. And also something that's future-proof. You know, we say at Ceres, you know, this is a no-regrets technology, as in you can put this technology in today and run it on natural gas. And if you could switch over to hydrogen overnight, the same technology would still run through, because we're just taking natural gas and converting it into hydrogen. So the fuel cell actually consumes hydrogen. So that's the first thing that really appealed to me about the technology. And then what's unique about our kind of solid oxide fuel cell is it was invented by a guy called Professor Brian Steele, who is a bit of a genius materials guy in Imperial College, and he did a lot of work on early lithium ion, etc. And what happened there is he saw the potential of solid oxide, but it was always very high temperature and very expensive and fragile ceramic materials. And what he managed to do was combine ceramics on steel so that he had the function of a solid oxide fuel cell, but with the cost and the attributes of steel, so low cost and very robust. And we're the only company in the world that has that type of fuel cell. And that's enabled us to have this licensing business model that we employ at Ceres, because we've got a highly differentiated and highly protected technology that many large corporates today realize that, you know, they want to have access to.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, actually, around the challenges of infrastructure and that sort of chicken and egg about no infrastructure and which you've touched on and often comes up whenever hydrogen is mentioned. The other thing that's interesting from a business point of view, and I don't know whether this was the case when you actually joined Ceres, was around this licensing model, because we all know how really challenging it is to get off any scalable manufacturing facility or technology. Was the company sort of licensing technology before you came, or was that something you introduced, and how has that sort of helped the company evolve and grow as it has done over the last sort of 5 or 6 years?
So my view on it was, when I was at Intelligent Energy, we adopted a licensing model, and it was, you know, when you think about energy conversion technologies, they need to be produced on a mass scale to really become an industry standard, and also to get down that cost curve that they need to achieve for widespread adoption. And if you think about, I think this is a mistake that a lot of startups make, is they kind of believe that from a small group of people, you can conquer the universe, and it's great, it will get you so far. But when you actually look at the balance sheet strength that you need to put down megawatts or gigafactories of scale, you realize that it's really the domain of the big incumbents in those industries. Now, it doesn't mean it can't be done. Tesla's an exception, maybe. But normally, when you look at who's going to win in these industries, it's the people with the strength in depth and the balance sheet strength to take it through. And I think, you know, My view is taking that approach. Well, if you look at what the UK does really well, we're fantastic at inventing technology. So we invented lithium ion battery, we invented the fuel cell, etc. But we tend not to be world leaders in those technologies. The manufacturing and the scale tends to happen elsewhere. And I think Arm in the chip industry created probably the last successful big UK tech company by developing core technology and licensing it. So essentially, we've taken that model and we apply it to fuel cells and extending it to clean energy technology. So we want to be the Arm of clean energy. And what we do is we license the core technology to people like Bosch and to Doosan, who then can lay down the manufacturing scale to take it to the mass market.
Yeah, Yeah, and that's again a theme that's come up quite often now, is around during this transition, and whether that's in energy or mobility or sort of the in-between parts, is those industrial partners who are so critical, not just from a financial perspective where they might invest in a startup, but where they actually give market and scale opportunities. And obviously a licensing is a way, I guess, of achieving that as well.
Yeah, and I think if you look at even amongst these large companies, like Daimler and Volvo, the first and second biggest truck manufacturers in the world, recently made a joint venture to do fuel cell trucks. You get companies like Honda and GM sharing fuel cell platforms because the development cost and the cost to bring it to market is still significant, even for those guys. So you see a lot more collaboration across the industry now in developing these new technologies that they need. And it's no different when you think about, you know, clean tech startups. Is, you know, our business model is all around collaboration and partnerships. And a lot of one of the big reasons why people work with Ceres is they like the people, they like the approach, but also the professionalism of the people and also the uniqueness of the technology. It's that combination that means that we are able to work very well with very strong engineering organizations like Bosch, for example.
Yeah, yeah. And Bosch clearly a global player in a multitude of sectors. And this week's announcement with Doosan, which again is a massive global entity. How did that come about? Is that something that's evolved, or was this a fresh deal? Or what's the sort of background to that, and how much of an impact will that have on your business moving forward?
Yeah, I think it's a big milestone for the company. Because it's really our biggest deal to date with a manufacturing partner looking to put down scale of production. So that's a 50 megawatt manufacturing facility in Korea. And Korea is the most progressive market for fuel cells globally right now, or certainly stationary power fuel cells. That takes those kind of deals, you know, that's a £43 million deal plus royalties. So over time, that's about £100 million worth of deal to Ceres. That you don't sign those kind of things overnight, and you have to become a trusted partner to these big companies. So, you know, we started. We identified Korea as a key strategic market about 4 or 5 years ago. So when I first came into Ceres, probably Japan and South Korea were probably the most active in fuel cells, so it made sense to put in place business development in those areas. And then it tends to start off on these companies want to come in and evaluate your technology, so they'll come in to Horsham in the UK and test our technology, and then we'll put technology on their site, and then and that can take up to a year, and then you start joint development where we'll actually help them to actually develop products based on our background IP. And we charge them engineering services for that. And then we also grant them a license, which is very high margin for us, where we give them rights to either manufacture the systems or manufacture the core technology that goes in those power systems. And then what that does is that gives us that ARM model, which is a very high margin, scalable model. And the beauty of that is we're able to play in multiple markets and multiple geographies at the same time. So right now, Ceres, from a base of approximately 300 people, is active in the South Korean utility market, is active in the EV bus and truck market in China, is active with Bosch, looking at stationary power, data centers, etc., in Europe and globally. Has products on sale in Japan. We wouldn't be able to do all of those market opportunities simultaneously if we were trying to be that whole product company. But because we stick to what we do best, which is the core technology, and we partner, we're able to scale the business in a very rapid way and address these huge market opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jumping back on something you touched on there, because it's something I thought about before when doing a bit of preparation for our conversation, was around how both with lithium iron, as you say, in terms of battery technology and with fuel cells, British innovations. But we've always struggled, it seems, to commercialize many of those innovations. And maybe that's why, from our perspective at Hyperion, we're doing much more with clients across Europe, continental Europe, Germany in particular, and the US, than here in the UK. And it can be quite frustrating, really. But I don't know if there's any particular answer to that, or don't sort of get too far diverted. But it's great to have a company who still has that global outlook and those partnerships where you are able to, I should say, playing so many big international markets and play with some of these significant companies. But it is something which I think can frustrate for, I know, a lot of startups who sort of look for accelerators and opportunities outside of the UK. But it's, I don't know if that's going to get any easier after next year for the obvious reasons.
Yeah, I think sometimes we equate success with manufacturing in the UK. And I think sometimes we're too UK centric. We have to take a global view. Climate change is a global issue that we all have. And success for me is building the next big UK tech success. I've been privileged enough to work with Apple. Apple don't manufacture in California. It's designed in California, made in China. It's fine for companies to develop a technology-rich environment where you're employing very highly skilled people, scientists and engineers. And that's what the UK should be doing. We've got a fantastic academic base, and we should be building world-class technology businesses rather than worrying about, are we doing enough on the manufacturing side? Because you mentioned lithium iron. History tells us, if you look at solar and you look at lithium iron and where fuel cells are today, we can learn from history. So solar, 25 years ago was a niche product, couldn't get down the cost curve, and then we had the right kind of subsidy regime, and then we had mass manufacture coming out of China and Korea, and now it's one of the cheapest forms of energy on the planet. And then same thing with lithium iron. If you remember EVs, less than 20 years ago, it was like a gee whiz. It wasn't taken seriously, right? And then you had the whole consumer electronics revolution, demand met by Japanese, Korean, and Chinese battery manufacturers. And today, most of lithium-ion batteries are dominated by manufacturing in those areas. If you look at our partners today, it's no accident that the Korean, Chinese, Japanese, and they've already identified fuel cells as the next big energy conversion technology that is needed to address climate change. And the same thing is going to happen again. There's going to be demand for these products that need fuel cells on a mass production scale. And our role, we believe in Ceres, as the technology innovation, is to really scale that business through those partnerships to get this technology to the mass market and literally can address the global issues of climate change.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's a really interesting thing. I mean, I got involved firstly in clean tech in 2007 through solar, funnily enough, and again, back in the day when it was about £3 a watt for a panel and significantly different. But that's one of the things that both EVs and solar, both, certainly in the last 10, 15 years have scaled in both in sort of a bit in their presence and profile, and obviously decreased significantly in their cost curves. And yet there's obviously a long-standing trope about hydrogen's been the next big thing for the last 40 or 50 years.
Absolutely.
But we really do seem to be seeing at the moment a significant investment and interest, in particular in green hydrogen, but, across the piece. I know it sounds an obvious question because that's your sector, but what part of the energy transition do you see as fuel cells and hydrogen having the most, I guess, a particular advantage? Because in so many applications, renewables and or batteries, tick most of the boxes, but clearly that they don't do everything. So where do you see in particular that fuel cells and hydrogen will play its key roles in the transition to a cleaner energy system?
Yeah, I think you kind of alluded to it a little bit in the question, which is I think hydrogen and fuel cells address the parts of the of society that are harder to reach from decarbonisation point of view. So you know, that with batteries and EVs and with solar, we can do quite a lot. However, I sometimes think people, you know, from a general perspective, kind of think that just addressing transportation is going to solve climate change. And you actually have to think about, if you think about the challenge for decarbonisation, it's roughly split a third in the residential and commercial buildings area, so the buildings that we live in and work in, the transportation sector, including shipping and aviation, etc., and then in industry. You know, most of our homes and buildings and society is built on steel and cement, and the petrochemical industry, where I started out, which are very heavily carbon intensive industries. And it goes back to an energy density kind of point of view. Is, we, you know, batteries will get you so far, but they don't carry enough energy per weight or per liter. And that's why we're addicted to fossil fuels, because the energy density of diesel is probably one of the most energy dense fuels there is. But hydrogen offers that potential as well, or using conventional fuels to a fuel cell that also offers a high efficiency. So where I see it is, you can start to decarbonize parts of society today using fuel cells, and you can go all the way through to zero carbon, zero emission power generation using distributed power with fuel cells running on hydrogen or synthetic fuels. If you think about decarbonization, first of all, of transport, as you go heavier on vehicles, so passenger vehicles, I think we can do with batteries only. But then when you start to go up into buses, trucks, shipping, etc., you just can't get the energy density on board from batteries alone. You need to use a fuel or synthetic fuel, and that could be hydrogen, or in shipping, it could be ammonia, or it could be a synthetic fuel in the future. So it's that trajectory that you need on transportation. And then when you think about power generation, you know, it's what's the most efficient way to power and heat our homes. That could be a combination of electrification, but also with fuel cells as well, to provide primary power or more efficient power than the power that we have today. And then where I think hydrogen is particularly interesting is in decarbonization of industry. So if you think about how to decarbonize steel, how to decarbonize cement, how to decarbonize petrochemicals, then you need to start to shift away from, say, coke as a reducing agent and start to use hydrogen in some of these industries. So I think hydrogen will play a key role in different areas of society, and you need to change your mindset of not just think about this argument about transportation and hydrogen versus batteries or fuel cells versus batteries in that context, because that's only a small part of the challenge that we face to decarbonize society.
It's interesting. I don't know if we've got a global audience, but when I was a bit younger, there was an advertisement from I think was it Heineken or Carlsberg, but it was around reaching the parts that other beers couldn't reach. And I heard the hydrogen referred to in that way as reaching the decarbonization parts that other technologies can't reach.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and I think the EU published a strategy paper only last month and literally said we won't hit our 2050 targets unless hydrogen plays a role in this, because I think, you know, it is one of the missing tools that we need to actually electrify society and decarbonize society.
Yeah, I think one of the frustrations I come across, and I'm guilty of it to some extent, because I do believe in sort of as much as possible the electrification and everything, and I'm certainly a battery nerd and geek, but it does tend to polarize. You do tend to get the sort of the battery versus the hydrogen people, and on both sides you tend to get this polarization, which I guess is a sign of the times to some extent, and that can be frustrating because, you know, all these things have their place or should have their place.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of what we do is, a fuel cell and a battery are very similar type of technologies. They're both electrochemical technologies again. And a battery is a storage device, and a fuel cell actually generates power. So very often when we're, for example, the project that we have with Weichai in China about electrification of heavy duty vehicles like trucks and buses, it's a combination of a battery that gives you dynamic response, but then a fuel cell that gives you range that turns that electric vehicle into something that gives you the equivalent performance of a vehicle today, short refueling times and distance or range, and they work very well together. So I find it really odd, particularly with clean tech advocates, that kind of get into these parochial arguments about which my technology is better than yours. There's this philosophy of we need every tool in the box. We do need every, you know, we need a lot of these technologies to come to the fore. And, you know, I think, you know, one of the philosophies we have at Ceres is if you have an electron and you can use the electron, then that's the best thing to do with it. So if you've got solar available and you can immediately use that power, then you should use it. And if you can use it directly in a battery vehicle, then you should use it. But that doesn't apply to all of society. And converting electrons to molecules and molecules back to electrons is what electrochemistry is all about. And if you think about fuel cells, that's working in one direction. And if you think about electrolysis, that's working in the other direction of converting electrons into green molecules like green hydrogen and then green ammonia and green steel and that side of things. And that's really where this pure electrification and batteries mentality is a little bit short-sighted, because it's not looking at the whole picture of what we need to actually address. And that's a whole new area that we're going into it with Ceres now is, you know, we've been very successful recently on the power generation side. And now we're starting to go into the electrolysis side of actually, if you run this technology in reverse, we can take renewable energy and create green hydrogen as a pathway to decarbonize some of these industrial processes. And that's really valuable going forwards.
Yeah. I think part of it is because a lot of, you know, everybody sees a car and everybody has a smartphone of some description, but not many people have been inside a steel mill or a paper mill or, you know, a kiln or some, you know, some of these really, I should say, carbon intensive, heavy industries. And they're often unseen, but they are clearly a massive part of the problem we need to solve.
Yeah. And that goes back to, you know, my formative years in ICI. I used to work in those industries. I used to work on pulp mills. I used to work on chemical plants. I used to work on massive scale electrolyzers. And then you have that industry perspective as well as the, you know, the automotive end of the market as well. It is an eye opener.
Yeah. Okay. Talking of eye-openers, actually, I'd like to move back to business and leadership a little bit, because a lot of the startups and founders I work with and interview on the podcast clearly are looking to scale their businesses, solve a problem, but also many looking towards an exit, and many of those looking at IPOs and listings and all. And there are many, many challenges as a startup entrepreneur or CEO, but equally, I'm quite sure there's as many but different as a CEO within a listed business. I mean, what are some of the big challenges that you've faced at the helm of Ceres over this period of time as a, you know, I should say, both a listed and a larger entity?
Well, when I came into Ceres, it was about 50 people, and so I don't, you know, that's a small entity, and even today we're now probably approaching 300, 350 people. So we're still a small to medium sized enterprise. But what I think is a challenge is, and I've seen this in the private side as well, is as you grow from 50 to 100 people, you get to a well-known inflection point about 100, 150 people, where you walk down the corridor of an organization, you might not know everybody by name anymore, and your informal processes don't work anymore. So you go through this whole transition of scale up, and it's hard. You know, so when you're a small startup, 10 or 50 people, it's great fun and everybody knows each other and you're all on the same mission and it's all very informal. And then as you grow and as you acquire customers, they demand more of you and you have to bulk up. You have to mature the organization to deliver to the standards of the likes of Bosch and Honda and Weichai and these world-class companies. Now, I've been in both worlds. Being private gives you a lot of flexibility. So you don't have to worry about your cost base reporting, you know, are you going to hit revenue targets, and all of that reporting that you do publicly. So there's a lot, you know, the US wouldn't tend to grow clean tech companies on the public markets. They would tend to grow them through private equity, and then you've got a lot more freedom and you can just go for growth at all costs almost. When I came into Ceres, it was already a listed entity. So, you know, it had its advantages in that being listed gave you an access to capital, you know, institutional investors. But you have to be consistent. You've got to be very, strike the right balance between your messaging and maturity, because you when you're a startup, you don't have predictable earnings. You can't always achieve year-on-year growth. You may have setbacks, and it's a lot more volatile on the public markets if you don't build up the confidence of the institutional investors. And when I took over at Ceres had, you know, it was listed already and it had a bit of a fall from grace. And initially we kind of almost took it dark for a while it takes a long time to rebuild confidence, particularly in the city, around the financial performance of a company. And you have to grow it back steadily. And it's all about being consistent and delivering what you said you would deliver. And that's hard in the uncertain world of clean tech startups. But I think what Ceres is benefiting from now is having grown and matured the last 7 years on the public markets. We're starting to see a wall of capital, ESG capital, environmental social governance, of investors now wanting to put money to work in companies that do good and companies with a purpose. So a company like Ceres that's, you know, all about clean energy for tackling climate change is suddenly an area that people want to invest in, which is very different from hydrogen 15 years ago. And that's when the public markets really work in your favor, because access to capital is no longer a problem. But you've got to get to a certain minimum size where it's no longer an issue. And then my experience is when I first started out at Ceres, I was kind of trapped in this cycle where you could only ever raise enough money to keep you going for a couple of years. It was kind of like in the UK, we have an Oliver Twist kind of approach to financing startups, which is, I'll give you enough money to see if you can get to the next base. Whereas in the US, it's like, I'll give you a big check and just don't bother me until you've got world domination. And I found myself going back every couple of years to the same investors, and they'd say, well, I know you're going to come back in a few years' time, Phil, for some more money, so I'm going to discount you. And every time you raise money and you make progress, they discount you back. And we kind of broke this vicious circle by getting some of our strategic partners to invest in the company. So this year, Bosch took just under a 20% stake in the company, and Weichai, who's the biggest engine manufacturer in China, also took a 20% stake in the company the year before last. And what that did is they not only invested in the company, but they invested at a premium to market, and they also gave it commercial contracts. And when that happens, then you get institutional investors following in, and then you can raise enough capital so you're not in this cycle of always raising capital, because the life of a public sector clean tech CEO can in the early years is continuously worrying about capital and raising capital and starting your next fundraise just after you've completed the last one.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you have to break that cycle and give these organizations, give these companies enough money to really have a good run at it and deliver the results. And that's how we've grown Ceres to the point today where, you know, we've got over 100 million of cash on balance sheet. That's more funding than we need right now in terms of to get to a point of maturity of our commercial contracts coming in. So, and the funny thing is when you don't need more capital, people want to give you more capital.
Yeah.
It's really odd. When you desperately need capital, people are always suspicious as to why you need their money. And when you don't need their money, they want to deploy it. because they want to back a horse that's already winning in the last furlong.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point, actually. And again, we find that across Europe, the money dropping from VCs and private equity is very different. I spoke to on the podcast Christoph Osterman, who exited out of Zonon to Shell eventually, but said as a CEO, 70% of his time was fundraising.
Yeah,
we have a few US clients where even at two or three person startups, they were dropping £100 million checks, which makes life a lot more interesting and a lot more. I'm not saying that it's not without challenges. Of course it's not, but they're different challenges, and it's a little bit easier when you've got a bank account like that than not. But I think it's
probably a good thing now that people are deploying more capital into clean tech, because let's face it, it's going to take significant investment to tackle issues like climate change. So access to capital and significant capital today is getting easier than, you know, you talked about hydrogen being around for 20 years or so. Hydrogen's got a terrible reputation for destroying shareholder value, and it's been really hard, you know, in the last 7 years to raise that capital. And it's become much, much easier in the past 2 years, basically.
Yeah. As the markets evolve. It's been really fascinating and fun to talk to you, Phil. Appreciate your time so far. I'd like to conclude by just looking at where over your career you've gone to or go to for inspiration, whether that's books or podcasts or media or thought leaders or any place that you've sort of that's inspired you along your journey, or perhaps where you return to when the going gets tough.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been lucky to work with a number of very supportive people throughout my career, and I go to, as a public company, sometimes you can kind of think the board is this kind of thing that keeps the chief exec at bay and is there to kind of, keep tabs on everything, make sure nothing goes amiss. But actually, a good board is incredibly supportive and incredibly additive and constructive. And I've been fortunate to work with a number of really, really good board members who, whenever I have a problem or I need support, I go to those people, and it's very much a collaborative approach. So that's very important to me. I mean, in terms of inspiration, I think, I've been in the industry quite a while, and you can read all kinds of things. I think there's a couple of things that I keep coming back to, more like management philosophies, really. When I first came into sales, everybody was reading, there was a book called Good to Great. And that was really interesting. It was about sort of what we just talked about how do companies make a leap from being good at something to being great? And why don't we in the UK make that leap? And I think one of the things that resonated with me, there was two things. One was, what do we do that nobody else can do? You know, what is it that we at Ceres do that is world class? And when Ceres went through a hard time at a turnaround point in its history, around the time I came in, it was really going back to basics. And it's like, well, we have this unique world class technology. And we can partner with people to do the rest of, the scale, the distribution, the marketing. But if we focus on that one thing and we get that right, then we can be a great company. And that was certainly something that I've adhered to throughout my career. And I think I would advise, sometimes when you get into a startup, you kind of think you can do everything and you try to grab everything. And I think people need to focus on what do you do better than anybody else? And then the second thing I believe in is employ the best people, get the best people on board, because I think sometimes as a leader, you think that you have to be making the final decision, you have to be, you know, over everything and doing everything. And actually, the advice of hire people smarter than yourself and enable them to succeed is definitely for me how Sarah's has grown. I've been privileged to be the chief exec there for 7 years, but what I inherited was a very talented team of people, and what we've grown and hired into is people with the right aligned with our purpose and our values, which is important to keep the culture of a company together as you grow, but hire the best people into that kind of culture and they will thrive. And those two things are, I think, management philosophies that are, you know, strength-based leadership and this good to great is definitely something that I get a lot of inspiration from. And I take inspiration from the people, you know, we're getting fantastic people in all the time, and that's what makes the company a great place to work.
Yeah, yeah. No, very key points, and I appreciate you sharing those with us. And clearly, as a CEO of a headhunting company, couldn't anything echo the second part of just making sure you have the very best people that align with your values and that are, I should say, invariably, hopefully better than yourself. The old adage, if you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room. And it's about bringing the right people around you to add to that and bringing the smartest people on board. But culture is another clear one, which we could talk about for a long time, but we're out of time. So appreciate you sharing those thoughts with us, Phil, and for taking us through a bit of your journey, and all power to Sarah's in the future.
Thanks, David. Thank you very much.